Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
Here at Real College Podcast, it's our hope that we ask the questions that you listeners are curious about, and that the stories we put together bring you inside the important issues from around the U. For this episode, we've partnered with The Wake magazine, another student-run media source which shares in our mission of creating discussion, awareness, and a sense of community on the Twin Cities campus. In our newsroom conversations over the past few months, it's come to our attention that crime around campus and the way in which the university authorities respond to it are complex issues which many students and faculty want to know more about. By joining forces with The Wake, we hope to provide you folks with multiple ways into these issues, covering them from different angles and in both article and podcast formats. Pick up an issue of The Wake or head over to wakemag.org today to supplement your listening experience. You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Nathan Fervoy. In all the requirements that go into maintaining a functional campus, safety is clearly a major piece. I mean, being terrified of an assault at any moment is not exactly conducive to getting a proper education. And so, most colleges, universities, and schools in general enlist some form of police or security to keep students safe and at ease, the University of Minnesota being no exception. Yet, in this time of increased visibility around police and law enforcement, it's become much harder to ignore that the law may not always serve all people equally. Today on RCP, we're looking into those questions that spawn from the tensions between who the system is built to protect and who it's not, here on the U of M. We're going to start with new reporter Zoe venturing into a dining hall here on campus to ask new freshmen their feelings towards the UMPD.
So I'll start with a kind of tough question. Do you feel that cops protect or patrol?
I think cops protect because they do a job of looking out for people, and obviously patrolling's part of that, so I guess they would patrol too, but
that's a hard question, dude. I don't know the answer to that. I really don't. Like, I like to hope that they protect, but I definitely see the harm that has occurred through their use of power. Like, enforcement as a concept is just kind of can be violent. But let's just say I hope that they're doing a good thing.
As a follow-up, would you just feel any different about, say, campus security?
Oh, campus security is definitely just like patrolling. I can't picture them actually doing anything real. Even if they have, like, weapons now, I heard. But, like that just seems like such an unnecessary thing. But, again, what do I really know?
I think in general, I feel like cops mostly patrol, but I've noticed like at the U, it's a little bit better than like just like on the street. I feel like cops, for the most part, are more conscious about like the way that they conduct themselves with students, at least on like the U campus. But yeah, so mostly I'd say protect.
I'd agree with that. I feel like at nighttime, it's a lot more of a patrol situation. Yeah, I don't feel like honestly, I don't feel comfortable like alone, walking alone at night, and then seeing a cop too. Like, I feel like kind of like pressurized, like under pressure too. So
this goes for both police enforcement outside of campus and campus security. Do you feel that they protect or patrol?
I guess I don't know enough about, like, for campus security in particular. I guess I haven't really heard of any, like, bad incidents and that sort of thing. I mean, I know I've heard a lot of conversation about when they send out, like, those mandatory safety reports and stuff. Like, oh, should they really say, like, what the color of the person's skin is when it comes to that sort of thing? But I think that's all that's really been on my radar for at least campus security in particular.
Yeah, I guess similar viewpoint to that. Like, I haven't really experienced either way in terms of them patrol. I haven't ever had the sense like, oh, they're patrolling me, or like, I can't do something because the police are here. But for the most part, I've heard like, oh yeah, they're just here to be like, make sure we're safe and protected. So yeah.
I don't think cops protect and patrol, because like there was like on the news, like their job isn't even to protect or serve. Like, it's a choice. They could choose to not help. So I feel like it's not their job, but like I would hope like it would be a requirement for them later on. What else are they supposed to be there for? I mean, like, they're getting paid, so.
I mean, ideally, yes, isn't their, like, motto to protect and serve. So I feel like they should be able to serve their people.
Do you guys ever find yourself hesitant to call the cops or police in a situation?
I feel like I would, just because, like, even though they have that law where you don't get in trouble, I'd still be scared I'd get in trouble. So
I feel like it also kind of depends on the situation and, like, who's involved, because sometimes, like, cops can have biases and things like that. So it's, like, if you're with someone who's, like intoxicated and they happen to be, like, of a community that's, like, targeted by cops, for example, you might be a little more, like, hesitant to call them because you're, like, I don't know how it's going to go. So that's, like, one thing that's kind of, like, alarming, I guess.
I 100% agree with her. You just have to think about the person that you're calling the police for as well, not just like about how it's going to implicate you, but how it's going to implicate them as well.
Do you think that you subconsciously rely on cops more now, considering that you are in school and in college, compared to being back at home?
I feel like I rely more on like the campus security versus like local police, simply because I feel like campus security are here for me versus local police. I feel like with all the news going on and like because of like just race issues, I feel like I wouldn't be safe calling the local police versus campus security.
Yeah, I agree with her. I feel more safe with the campus security as well, because I mean that's essentially their job, correct?
And do you know if any of your peers, especially like of your class, have any opposing views about police enforcement, or is it even really discussed?
Well, I know personally that, like, my roommate actually really, really does not like police officers, like, pretty strongly, you know, like, that's sort of just, like, I know, like, the, whatever the anti-Blue Lives Matter movement would be, is, like, so I'd say that in that way, it's definitely talked about from time to time. Like, I remember, you know, like, over, like, people have definitely talked about it, but there's always generally someone in a group whenever it happens that is like, are you sure, guys? Are you really over, are you overreacting a little bit? So, I don't know. It's general, I guess it is discussed a bit.
Thank you, guys.
In one example of students critical of police taking action, the U of M student group Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS, has launched a campaign calling for the University of Minnesota Police Department to be disarmed in response to a perceived hostility from campus police against marginalized groups of students. Producer Tosin Fasimo looks at the relationship between cops and students on this university's campus compared to that of another.
Living in a major city is exciting. It has everything. There are more people, more activities, and more opportunities. For most people, this is enough reason to choose to attend a school in an urban setting. However, for some, schools in densely populated areas carry a significant drawback: more crime. Here at the University of Minnesota, college students rely on the University of Minnesota Police Department to provide protection from everyday crimes. But not every student supports the UMPD's presence on campus.
So we're trying to take real, actionable steps to de-escalate their current militarized state.
That's Olivia Kroll. She's a member of Students for a Democratic Society, also known as SDS. They're a progressive group on campus with a current campaign to disarm the UMPD.
So the whole premise of the Disarm UMPD campaign is that we think that this campus should be a gun-free campus, and right now it is not, because the police are still armed. And so with the actual, like, specific types of crimes that are occurring on this campus, it's mostly nonviolent, it's mostly petty theft, yet we have a highly militarized police force.
SDS views the UMPD's disarmament as a major step toward improving relations between the university and students from marginalized groups.
We feel like it's appropriate that they, you know, be an unarmed, more security task force, especially since it, you know, has the potential to make students of color on campus feel uncomfortable, unsafe, unwanted. So yeah, it's all kind of in a broad-based platform of trying to make the U a more inclusive and more like racially just and equitable place.
This emphasis on justice reveals a disconnect between student perceptions and UMPD officers' motives. While it's obvious the campus police are supposed to ensure the safety of students, it's hard to ignore the fact that many students are uncomfortable in the presence of police officers. One potential reason for this is the lack of communication between students and the UMPD.
How do we send messages or give students this information of how to be safer on or off campus when they decide to move off campus into?
That's Ola Adebayo, a student at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. Campus Police Chief Mark Glenn created a student advisory committee in 2018 to improve relations between students and the Washington University Police Department. Ola is a member of that committee, so I called her to discuss a recent meeting.
We would kind of just touch base on the things that we initially discussed that we wanted to talk about at our very first meeting, and that includes like the transparency bias reporting, how UPD interacts with marginalized communities and homelessness, as well as mental health.
In talking to Ola, it became clear to me that a key part of maintaining a positive student-police relationship is this direct involvement of students in police affairs. That's something that's missing here at the U, where students aren't given information about police actions until well after the fact. Usually, this is seen as a mundane part of the UMN experience. A random safety alert at 3 a.m., a vague email in the middle of the day, all describing things that are brushed off as minor occurrences. However, sometimes, this lack of communication can contribute to an atmosphere of panic and confusion. This occurred in January 2018, when a man barricaded himself in the Graduate Hotel for 2 days in a rumored hostage situation. Classes weren't canceled, and little information was given about the situation, aside from a mysterious video in which a microwave was thrown out of a window. This incident is well known amongst UMN students, as the video was used to create a variety of memes online. But there are other examples of the UMPD getting involved in situations, not efficiently communicating with students, and failing to provide an adequate explanation of their actions after the event.
Given, you know, the events of like Somali Night a few years ago, when they super overreacted and like came in full force with a bunch of other police departments, like Minneapolis Police, even Edina Police, I believe, and brutalized many individuals, and you can see, like, SSA's statement on that.
Somali Night, as Olivia mentioned, is an annual cultural event hosted by the Somali Student Association. Their April 2018 event, which took place at Northrop Auditorium, was disrupted by an influx of police officers in response to a report of multiple fights breaking out at the end of the night. This is where the details become blurry. While both the UMPD and SSA released statements on the event, each group offered radically different accounts of what happened. The UMPD claimed that fights involving 30 to 40 individuals lasted over an hour after the arrival of police, whereas the SSA claimed that there were only 2 3-minute fights that night. Regardless of this discrepancy, both groups acknowledged the presence of multiple police officers, as well as the use of chemical irritants on the crowd. Events like this explain the tension that exists between students and campus police.
We think that the UMPD is not necessarily a friend to students and that they have not acted that way historically and will continue to probably not act that way. So we're trying to take real actionable steps to de-escalate their current militarized state and kind of, I don't know, make campus a more inclusive place.
The UMPD's relationship with students is far from perfect. While some students are openly distrustful of campus police, others are merely ambivalent about their presence. While an increase in communication wouldn't instantly solve the rift between the two groups, it definitely couldn't hurt. For Real College Podcast, I'm Tosin Fasimo.
The Safe U and Timely Warning Alert System is meant to communicate and help keep the campus community safe. But the vague messages highlighting crimes in the area are something many students and faculty are critical of. I looked into whether the system might also be contributing to a safety bubble, serving students at the expense of a neighboring community. The University of Minnesota, as you might have noticed, is massive, spread out over hundreds of acres with its own governing system, recycling plant, and police department. Vice President of University Services, Mike Berthelsen, puts it this way.
University, in many respects, operates as a city. So we have our own police department. If you call 911 on campus, it goes to our dispatchers, which then dispatch our police department. So we are independent, and it's operating as a city within the city.
Not only does the U operate as its own self-contained city, but it feels quite self-contained to the students who attend full-time. Most services, academic or otherwise, are provided for on or near campus, meaning there's rarely a time students will find they need to venture far outside their bubble. Yet, of course, while it might be easy for students to forget, the main campus sits within the major urban center that is Minneapolis, home to over 400,000, and an environment likely quite different from the suburbs many students are coming from.
Like, what does it mean to live in a very urban environment in the middle of a very large metropolitan city? And
Berthelsen and the university police department he oversees are tasked with keeping the campus safe, from broad threats like extreme weather to the pointed assault, a major piece of which they believe is making the campus community aware of possible threats.
Because we want to make sure people are aware of what's happening around them, but that may not.
The new SafeU Alert system is the central tool safety services have at their disposal for reaching students and faculty at all hours, via either email, text, phone, or a combination of the three. It centralizes the formerly separate timely warnings and cuts out the middlemen, giving UMPD the discretion to send out alerts directly, all with the goal of improving speed.
It should be, as soon as possible, which I feel like if you're warning people about a suspicious person, like, if we don't know, like, an hour after it happens, like, there's no point, really.
Had identified that the timing of our response we didn't feel was adequate in the turnaround of our communications. And so, but I think the general theme of us trying to communicate has been the same. What's shifted over time is technology. Long time ago, it was tone alert radios, then email. Then now what's happened is the proliferation, of course, of smartphones to the point that vast majority of people have a smartphone with them at all times.
I asked if this development in alert technology has made campus a safer place overall.
That's a good question. I think it has allowed us to communicate better, and has it made us safer? There's lots of variables to that. It gives us a capacity to give us another tool to help people have the right information to make safe choices.
Do you remember receiving the rabid bat notification?
Yes. Yeah.
So I do remember that. Right, yeah. In the mall, I think it occurred.
Now, students are probably familiar with this year's rabid bats and tween scooter gang incidents. The campus-wide alerts are one of the few commonalities between all students at this large university. Sent out to each and every student phone, they feed conversation between classmates and a strong campus meme collective.
Yeah, and do you remember receiving, like, the most recent one, for example?
But there is also the sense among some that the system might also be feeding into long-standing narratives of fear and division between campus and its surrounding communities.
About the person that was either assaulted with a gun or something happened, someone had a gun, but yeah.
For new freshmen at the U, a common message to hear passed around by peers is, bring your pepper spray if you're going out near the west bank of campus into the Cedar Riverside neighborhood.
I think it's just known through the U not to really be on west bank alone at night. It's just kind of known not to be there. I remember when my brother showed me around the U, he was like, don't go here at night, and that was it. I was like, okay.
Placed into its proper context, the message to stay away, coming from predominantly white students about the only community boarding the U with a large African immigrant population, becomes tinged with race. A 2019 survey of students by the Minnesota Student Association presented these numbers. Under 2% of students live in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood, while over 20% live in Dinkytown, another neighborhood bordering campus. And while the vast majority of students visit Dinkytown frequently, nearly two-thirds of students responded that they never visit the Cedar Riverside neighborhood for recreational purposes. The survey fits with the general sentiment students shared about the western border of campus, that Riverside Avenue is the edge of the student bubble and a divider between the two communities.
That went out just like a day or so ago.
Yeah, there was an armed robbery, I think, on Riverside, which happens like every weekend, but for some reason we can't seem to figure out like the idea of patrolling that area when it's literally...
Another sign of the divide is the differing feelings towards the police and the two communities. While there is no consensus among students regarding police on campus, across Riverside Avenue, the feelings are consistently negative.
I just don't like the police. The police... our tyranny. They're like tyrants. You know what I'm saying?
Has it gotten, like, physical? Has it gotten rough?
It is. I got slammed a year ago over here by police.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't like the U of M being around where I live because they have their own type of police. And that, like, makes it, you know, it makes it weird when UMPD police comes to my property looking for somebody, you know.
That does not live here.
And then he, like, eventually, he thinks I'm that person, and he stops me and some shit, you know?
Racial profiling.
It turns out that while the divide keeps most students out of Cedar, the university police, primarily tasked with protecting students, do indeed cross over, something Berthelsen confirmed.
Our staff are, you know, as needed, in cooperation with Minneapolis police, will assist or support them.
The UMPD, combined with the regular Minneapolis Police Department, result in a heightened presence of police in Cedar, a presence that no resident I spoke with felt as beneficial to the community.
Yeah,
we need the police to do better. We need the police to protect everybody, the neighbor, the community, you know, and, you know, just be fair, and we all want to feel safe and know that the police are there to protect us. And if we don't feel that, then that causes a problem, and it's sad, but yeah.
And half of the cops who are established here, they don't really live in the neighborhood. So a lot of them, like, they come with this fear of, you know, whatever their training was based off. And they need to just come in the community. Just, you know, on every vehicle it says to protect and serve. Like, come protect and serve and break bread and get to know us and get to know our parents and get to know our siblings. And a lot of these kids, like, they get, like, the wrong rep, or, like, people don't really, like, you know, they stigmatize them just because of, like, maybe, like, one bad apple caused something or did something bad, just, and then due to, like, you know, layers of setbacks, layers of, like, you know, obstacles that they're going through. And say,
residents of Cedar Riverside don't hide the fact that their community has its share of serious issues. In fact, my short visit to the neighborhood happened to overlap with a public memorial of 29 candles representing the 29 young lives lost to drug overdoses in Cedar since January.
I knew some of these brothers, some of these sisters, in fact.
If I had the resources, I really want to improve this community, because a lot of youngins out here don't really, I don't think we really get enough support to improve ourselves.
This lack of essential resources and support exists right alongside the vast financial and academic resources of the U. Yet the invisible divide between the communities may be stopping the possible exchange.
A high-end university that have, like, the toppest, you know, technology and resources right there.
Yeah.
But yet, because of some weird invisible barrier that you can't see, I feel like you're not allowed to access these resources that could use. Like, this neighborhood doesn't have a library. Meanwhile, there's a giant library right there. But
hi!
Hey.
Hello.
What's your
My
name?
Final question for Vice President Berthelsen was if the UMPD or University Services were aware of this division and if they were taking measures to address the larger issue.
You know, I'm aware that I don't think there's a great deal of interaction between the neighborhood and the West Bank and the university.
While efforts have been made to reduce negative stigmatization and retalization as a result of SafeU alerts by removing identifying traits deemed unnecessary, no program is currently in place to bridge the divide.
You know, we do pay attention to the neighborhood relations and how we work with the city of Minneapolis, but we don't have a particular outreach program today that goes beyond that.
What's your favorite thing to do in this neighborhood?
Having fun.
For students, one Cedar Riverside resident has this message as an alternative to fear.
Tell your classmates that there's a lot of good restaurants.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
They have sambusa. You know, sambusa is very good. It's very popular. Everybody loves sambusa, no matter what culture you're coming from or background. So it's very delicious. So people come and check the sambusa, do it in a tattoo. We have a lot of things. We have good clothes, you know? So let's get to know each other and, you know, build a long-lasting relationship.
Another piece of living within an urban setting is witnessing homelessness. Oftentimes, the sight of homeless people is associated with a feeling of insecurity, even a fear of crime. But as RCP reporter Ben Hallam investigates, it's often the unhoused themselves whose safety is most at risk.
It doesn't seem right that someone can be thrown in jail for the crime of not having a home. But that's exactly what happened to Randy, a formerly homeless man who shared his story with me for the podcast.
And I was catching the bus, actually, and I went into the terminal. It was on 7th Street. So I sit there probably 10 minutes, and then the security guard was like, well, you have to leave. You have to get out of here. You're homeless, and you just can't sit here. I said, I'm not going nowhere. I have bus fare. He called the cops. The cops came, and when I handed them the community ID, they was like, oh, you're homeless. Well, did he tell you to leave? And then they said, well, you're under arrest. So they arrested me for trespass. What wound up happening was when I went to court, they were expecting for me to plead guilty. And I said, no, I'm taking this to trial. So just so happened that my lawyer got the video, and the video showed me just sitting there. And I was found not guilty. And that was sticking in my mind forever. The reason why the police took me to jail, because I was homeless.
This sort of experience, being thrown in jail solely for being or even looking homeless, is a common one for the unhoused residents of Minneapolis and St. Paul. According to U of M Geography PhD candidate Eric Goldfisher, that's because homeless people have become a visual signifier for urban decay, poverty, and crime. They are seen as a blight to be contained, rather than a logical consequence of our capitalist housing system. I spoke to Eric over the phone from New York, where he works on homelessness advocacy.
I think that's kind of a central dynamic around the visuality of homelessness, is that homeless folks are used as a visual red herring. That has a lot to do with race, right? It has a lot to do with gender and ability and deviance, and is a way to demarcate who does and who does not belong in public space. You know, the sight of a homeless person indicates a neighborhood is unsafe, or a street is unsafe, or a park is unsafe. The way that homeless people are seen visually has a huge impact on the larger policies that form around homelessness, right? So in other words, most public policy that gets formed around homelessness is formed off of particularly visual ideas of homelessness, not necessarily on the fact of not having a home. You would think that policy would have to do with trying to provide people with homes, but instead, if you look at policies around homelessness, they usually have much more to do with policing, and they have to do with keeping people in certain spaces and away from other spaces. And so that's kind of was my starting point in thinking about...
To find out what impact this policing-first approach to homelessness has on homeless communities, I spoke to Erica and Chris, two outreach workers with St. Stephen's, a major homelessness services provider in the Twin Cities. According to them, this focus on policing leads to a pattern of shifting camps that, while providing the appearance of safety for housed people, puts the unhoused at risk.
So there's essentially this pattern of people trying to set up a camp somewhere or just sleep somewhere and not necessarily even have a camp set up and just being moved along and told, well, you can't sleep here. So then they don't have a place to go still, so they'll move down the block. And then somebody else tells them, well, you can't sleep here. So people are kind of just being moved around. People's belongings end up just being taken and thrown away if their camp is cleared out or if they're told that they can't stay in a spot. So people are frequently losing possessions, and sometimes those are things that are really important to them. Sometimes they're personally important, but they also could be important for survival even.
A lot of it is perception of being unsafe by community members, the people that are calling and asking for these cleanouts.
Randy, the formerly homeless man, shared his story of a camp cleanout and how it brought an end to a community that provided a small slice of security.
And that's, you know, if you're, the way they deal with homeless people, and I'm not saying all the police officers, is they just put you in jail to get rid of you. You're looked up on as like a disease, you know, where they're sitting there and they're saying to themselves, well, we're going to clean this up and we're going to have an image and we're going to push these worthless people out of the way. Hillside, that's the place we had that was safe, that were homeless. We were all homeless. We looked out for each other and stuff, and we slept there. And the police would come over and tell us to leave. You're constantly told to move, and you have nowhere to go. You're constantly on the move. You have no time to think about nothing else but how am I going to survive? You say it's the cycle. They call it the trail. That's what it's called when you're homeless. I'm going to hit the trail. You know, everybody knows what that means.
These policies, which treat homeless people as a risk, ignore one simple fact. Homeless people are more at risk than anyone. Here's Chris and Erica speaking about some of the risks homeless people face.
In terms of safety, the people that are living on the streets are much more likely to be the victims of violence and to be robbed and have their things stolen due to the fact that they don't have a safe place to be at night. So when we are talking about safety, and I think it's important to remember that the people that are staying on the streets, due to the fact that we don't provide housing for everybody, are exposed to very real violence. Speaking generally, every day we see people that have been assaulted the night before or have been robbed or have had that kind of thing happen.
There's also a large extent to which people who end up homeless may be homeless because of experiencing some kind of abuse or trauma. So to illustrate that, about 1/3 of women experiencing homelessness are homeless because of some kind of domestic abuse or violence.
When the real safety concerns are taken into account, the safety concerns of homeless people, maybe it doesn't make sense to keep homeless people out of the way, to push them to the margins, or to imprison them. Maybe one way to deal with homeless people is to create a public space that is welcoming for everyone, and to provide public housing for the unhoused members of our community. Here's Eric.
But I think there's something to be said for the idea of just letting people be, as long as they're not actively hurting themselves or hurting someone else, right? That would also get to the idea of seeing homelessness differently, right? There's a certain point in which you have to directly attack that image of homeless people as causing harm or homeless people as dangerous, and changing the image of homelessness to not be a person, but to instead be like a building that's being, you know, held vacant by a landlord so that he can get more money off it when gentrification hits a neighborhood, right? Or, you know, changing the image of homelessness to be a shelter, which looks like a prison, basically, rather than a person on the street.
As homelessness and the safety concerns it produces becomes an increasingly common topic in political discourse, it's important to remember the communities who are most at risk, the unhoused people themselves. For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
That's all for this episode. Thanks to the many people who shared their voices and to the team at The Wake magazine. Special thanks to Zoe Challenger for chatting with those freshmen. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Ben Hallam, Tosin Fasimo, and Lizzie Ritchie. I'm Nathan Fervoy, your host and managing editor. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online at RadioK.org or on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and now on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Instagram for a look behind the scenes. Thanks for listening.